He is a professor of international relations and business at USC, with appointments in both the School of International Relations and the Marshall School of Business. He's also the director of the Korean Studies Institute there. Dave's latest book, East Asia Before the West, or Is East Asia Before the West, Five Centuries of Trade and Tribute. He's also the author of China Rising, Peace, Power, and Order in East Asia. Both of these are with Columbia, and both of them I have used in my classes, and I feel that I'm just
I owe you dinner.
Sort of a little bit of a kickback for that. Although he doesn't need me. Unlike my own books, Dave's books actually sell quite well. His work has also appeared in international organization, international security, and other top outlets for the study of international relations and Asian security. He's written op-eds in the New York Times, Washington Post, and others. Another thing I've found that I haven't been as successful with as Dave has been. And as a brief aside, and I think this is apropos for this Dave giving a talk here in Ithaca, I believe it was in 2001, Peter Katzenstein, J.J. Su, and I organized a workshop that led to the edited volume we did, Rethinking East Asian Security. And at that workshop, Peter, observed towards the end quite quietly, I don't know if you recall this, and this may not be as much of a moment for you as it was for me, but that someone should write a world politics style review article about Asian security, raising questions about realism and its application to the Asian security sphere. Neither JJ or I followed up on the idea, and I guess it didn't register at least consciously in Dave's mind, but he did. And he wrote a piece, and I asked that it ends up being one of its more frequently downloaded articles over the past 10 years, and has become a major voice in the study of Asian security and international relations theory. So it's with great enthusiasm that I introduce him all to you.
Thank you. Wow. Thanks so much for inviting me, Alan, Dick. And the rest of you who voluntarily came here, evidently, the students in Alan's class. I know you all can't wait. There's nothing you'd rather do on Monday afternoon. I'm delighted to be here at Cornell. I've only been here a couple times, and it might have been the most recently, it might have been 2001. But I've always enjoyed coming. So I'm delighted to be here. I am going to try and talk, and please forgive me, because I caught a cold, believe it or not, while I was in L.A., I caught a cold, not here. So I hope I don't cough too much or something like that. But I am going to try and talk to you today about the thing I've been, the sort of line I've been pushing for the last 10 years or so. And what I find interesting about it is I was just having with some of the grad students, and I was talking to some of the other, some of my colleagues, and I was saying the thing that motivates me and has ever since, the late 90s or whatever, has been the difference between what I know about East Asia and then the difference about the way that we talk about it here in America. Because the way we talk about it doesn't always seem to fit with what's actually going on the ground. And so I did. I wrote that piece in 2003, and it got far more of a reaction than I thought. So I just kept, plowing that row or something. And one of the things, the basic way that I sort of think about it is like this. If anybody knows anything about Korea, that you can always get 100,000 Koreans out to protest against Japan. And I'm going to talk about this later. It's a national sport, right? They're concerned about certain things. China's one of them. It's not the only one. In fact, it's probably not the major one. In the United States, on the other hand, we are centrally concerned with a giant panda taking over Wall Street, or the dawn of a new dynasty, right? How are we going to react to China? That is clearly the predominant preoccupation that we have when we talk about East Asia. And it's not just the popular press. What's funny is the guy I love to attack the most, but he doesn't notice because he's an endowed chair at Princeton, so he doesn't pay any attention to me, is Aaron Friedberg, who has made an entire career of predicting that China's rise is going to cause instability and balancing and fear in East Asia. So this is a big article in 1993-94, and then he just published another book almost 20 years later on the same topic, that China's rise is going to unsettle East Asia. Now, I'm going to give you one genuine golden nugget of advice And then I'm going to tell you my argument, and then I'll tell you what we're going to do today. The big piece of advice, and for all of you, particularly undergraduates, if you're ever at a cocktail party or you're in a job interview or whatever else, and someone asks you something about international relations and you don't know, right? What's going to happen to the euro? What's going on in Afghanistan? What about China's rise? You can never go wrong being a skeptical realist, meaning, I don't know, I'm really, really worried. Power is all that matters in international relations. I don't know. Situation doesn't look good. Afghanistan, euro, it's going to fall apart, right? Power is all that matters. We're an incredibly macho profession. Power, right? You can never go wrong. So seriously, if you don't know, no one will ever accuse you of being naive. Oh, you're so naive. You can be 100% wrong, right? It's been predicting for 20 years that there's going to be arms racing and rivalry in East Asia. And he's a hard-headed, rigorous thinker. But my argument is different. My argument is, I don't think stability in East Asia is going to be a function of a stable balance of power. China's getting too big, so we have to balance against them and make sure they don't become too dangerous. Or the East Asian states are going to balance against China. And I'll explain what we mean in case you don't know. But I mean, almost everybody knows what the balance of power is. It's pretty self-evident, right? I don't think that's the case. And I don't think it's actually the case of that. Or whether economic interdependence will weave us together and overcome the threats of balancing behavior. I actually think it's not either one of those things that's going to determine stability in East Asia, but rather it's going to be this other thing that's much more squishy, but I think it's much more important, which is, can the countries in East Asia come together with a set of understandings about what each other wants and what each other is? A sort of, I call it identities. It might be a shared set of values. They don't have to believe the same things. But can other countries in particular come to an understanding of what China wants and China is? And can China come to an understanding of what it wants and what it is that other countries don't find threatening? Now, that's very interesting, right? I mean, in some ways, what I'm doing is making an argument that gets into all this other stuff. As Dick mentioned, it gets into what history is. There's a lot of unresolved tensions in East Asia. There's a lot of things that are not as stable as they are, say, in America or Europe. But I don't think it's a function of the balance of power or economic interdependence. Because actually, interestingly enough, in IR, and for political science, any of you poli-sci majors or IR majors, right, there's two things that we're really, really comfortable with. There's two human motivations that we take for granted. That's power and wealth, power and wealth. What's more important? Well, it doesn't matter. If I have power, I can take wealth. If I have wealth, I can buy power, right? Those are two that we know really well, balance of power or economic interdependence. But there's actually three fundamental human motivations, and the third one we're really uncomfortable with. For lack of a better word, let's call it values. How do you get somebody to do something? Hit them with a stick? Coerce them, power, bribe them, I'll give you money. But the easiest way, and anybody who's ever taught a class knows this, that only works so far. You have to inspire people. You have to get them to buy into what you're doing. You have to convince them. And I think that motivation we're not comfortable with, but I think it's probably much more important in East Asia. Values, and I'm going to talk about this a lot as we go through. I think that's what's motivating countries. The other things matter. I'm not saying they don't matter at all. But I don't think that's really what's going on. So what I'm going to do today, and I'm going to try and be as short as possible so that we can talk, because what I have found is usually I think things are just so obvious, and I'm so convincing, but usually there's a lot of discussion. So I'm going to talk a little bit about this theory stuff, authority, legitimacy, what do I mean when I talk about values and things like that. And then I'm going to talk about East Asia today and why I don't think the models work. The easy, off-the-shelf IR models that we take for granted don't work. And the example that I'll use and the little bit that I'll talk about China, I'm going to talk about Chinese nationalism as an example of what I mean. And then I'm going to conclude, and then we can talk about whatever you would like. So, you know, roughly, balance of power, as everybody knows, realism is very straightforward. If a country gets too big, it could potentially invade other countries. Power is all that matters in international relations. Big countries are threatening. Small countries are afraid. Therefore, small countries balance together and even out the power so the big country can't invade. In fact, it's an IR theory, but it's now public discourse. right? We talk about it all the time. It's in the popular lexicon. Same thing with economic interdependence. Economic interdependence started out as a theory, now we use it, right? If we're two countries trade a lot with each other, they have a lot of incentive not to fight. It's very straightforward. But this third one is very interesting, right? Because there's a whole bunch of ways that we use all the time to talk about it. Even though we're very comfortable talking about power and wealth, why do countries do things? We're always actually talking often about these other things, values, whatever you want to call them. And let me give you some examples. The best example I can think of in America today is leadership. We are always talking about America as a leader. America as a leader. And I have a slide here. Let me make sure I get this right. Right. There's too many things around here. Where is Maya? There it is. Right? Hillary Clinton, America's Pacific Century, blah, blah, blah. So we have to sustain our leadership. And it's not just politicians who talk about it. Academics talk about it. Will China and the U.S., who will be the leader in Asia, the leader in Asia? But the interesting thing about that is if you think about leadership, right, the thing about leadership is that it's inherently social. If I'm hitting you with a stick, I'm not much of a leader, right? Follow me, right? That's Kim Jong-il. That's North Korea, right? Not much of a leader, right? I mean, that's part. Or if I'm saying, here, if you follow me, I'll give you a lot of money, that's okay. But most of the time when we talk about leadership, most of us would admit that America is not a leader today simply because we're rich and powerful, although that's part of it. It's also part of the kind of values that we portray. We don't live up to them, but we clearly have a set of articulated values that other countries find legitimate, that they want to follow. They think that's good. You take the hard steps. The other thing about leadership that is also inherently social is Without followers, there's no leader. You have to have the consent of the followers to be a leader. We all know countries that, and again, I'm going to pick on Korea since I'm Korean, right? Korean presidents are always saying, we're going to be a leader, right? And I read all these op-eds in Korean newspapers. I say, nobody's following you. Nobody's looking to Korea for solutions, right? Leaders need followers. It is an inherently social concept. And if you use it, you are talking about the kind of things I'm talking about. How do you become a leader? You have to convince other people. If you talk about convincing, persuading, inspiring, you're talking about the things I'm talking about. So anytime we use them, and scholars use them all the time, we're talking about that area that I'm interested in. The easiest other way to think about it is like soft power. Soft power is a concept we know. It's not hitting you on the stick, it's convincing you somehow, right? Little Hello Kitty, Gross National Cool, I Love K-Pop. Who here knows Girls' Generation? Okay, see. Sonia, she did, right? For those of you who don't, anyway. We can talk about that another time. But, right, if we start talking about soft power, which we do all the time, we're talking about, can I convince you of something that I'm actually a nice person, right? Now, unless you're dumb, are you going to just take me at face value because I have a Hello Kitty or something, right? It's much deeper than that if you start thinking about it. It's like, what do you stand for? Who are you? How do you think you fit with me? How do I think I fit with you? And those are the kinds of issues that are really driving East Asia today. Right? Another example that I would use is, just one last word, and I'm saying this just because you guys may have heard it, is the term hegemony. Right? We talk about hegemony all the time. If hegemony is just being bigger than everyone else, that doesn't mean a whole lot. But hegemony usually means there's a set of values out there that smaller countries think, hey, we want to live up to. So in many ways, these are the kinds of things I'm talking about. And we use them in IR, but we're not comfortable if we make them explicit. They're usually thrown in at the end. So why do I think this works in East Asia, right? Well, part of this is how we learned about international relations, right? Part of what I said in my, or one of my bailiwicks, is much of our theories are derived on the European experience. And the European experience, historically and today, is a bunch of countries, roughly the same size, competing viciously for the slightest advantage for literally centuries. So they're basically all the same size. And today, it's roughly the same. Germany has 80 million people, Italy has 60 million people, roughly $1 trillion or $2 trillion economies. So the lesson from the European experience was that the balance of power is a very important thing, because that's what occasionally kept countries from killing each other, you know, slaughtering each other in Europe. And interestingly enough, not only the balance of power is not only a good thing, it's an inevitable thing, because the Europeans had centuries of seeing the balance of power play out was a bunch of similarly sized countries competed with each other. And there's a bunch of other normative values things that came out, right? From the French Enlightenment or the liberal thinkers, Rousseau, Locke, whatever else, equality is very important. We hold these truths to be self-evident, right? Obvious. We hold these truths to be obvious that all men are created equal. Where's that from? Right? So not just a state of life, a fact of life, is equality the most important thing, balance of power, equality. But it's also a normative goal. And of course, Westphalia today. All countries are the same. Although, interestingly enough, and I'm not picking on anyone who's Bolivian, right, but Bolivia and the United States, you know, just intuitively, they're not the same. They're not equal on any measure. Size, population, influence, military, economy, those are totally different countries. But because we both call them this Westphalian thing called nation state, they're the same, sort of, until they're not. Right. In other words, I think we have an idea of what the way the world should be, but we don't often live up to it. And what's interesting, I'm going to conclude and please make sure that if I don't, somebody raise your hand and say, you were going to conclude with something you think is really cool. And most of you probably won't, but I've got something to conclude at the end of that, right? So that's what we learned. And most of our theories were derived to explain that European experience. That's okay, we can admit it. Europe was the locus, that was the center. Now, interesting enough, if you go to East Asia, and you can go back 500 years and measure population, GDP, et cetera, et cetera. I was going to do this, but I don't want to waste too much time. It was the same thing. Right? China has always been so much bigger than the rest of these countries. Here's Japan. This is the world's second largest economy. 130 million people, and it looks like a bump compared to China, where you put South Korea and Indonesia with 200 million people. So what's the conclusion from the East Asian historical experience? It's not balance of power. It's not equal states. And the kinds of relations that developed weren't relations and institutions in international relations developed to deal with a bunch of similarly sized states. There are a bunch of things, rules, norms, whatever, designed to deal with very uneven states. Hegemony is a fact of life. Unequalness is a fact of life in East Asia. It's a very different experience, a very different historical experience, very different cultural experience. A lot of interesting things that you can think about in terms of how this as an international system, as a region historically, might have functioned very differently from Europe. Sounds like a great book. Can I make my joke? It'll make a great Valentine's gift. No. No, don't try that. Your girlfriend or boyfriend will not be happy. But, right, the current debate today is whether the balance of power will overcome interdependence or whether interdependence will overcome the balance of power in East Asia. But again, I think that's trying to squish into East Asia a set of dynamics that don't necessarily fit. Trying to force them in because that's what we're comfortable with. Excuse me. And frankly, China is not helping out a whole lot. We used to talk about China's smile diplomacy. They seem to be more snarling the last couple years. A lot of interesting questions why. But certainly China, this is after the Japanese Coast Guard, this Chinese fishing boat rammed the Japanese last year or so, right? A lot of incidents like that. But my fundamental claim, this is more vivid. South Korea. So that's sort of frown diplomacy. Here we have South Korea's total trade. Here's trade with China, Japan, and the United States from 1995 to 2009, over 14-year period. What's remarkable about this, and every single country in the region has done the same thing, is that Korea used to be focused totally on Japan and the United States. China wasn't an important target. Not only has it become by far the largest trading partner of South Korea, but extremely quickly. And this is the same as Japan, as Southeast Asia, as Vietnam, every other country in the region. They're focused on China economically. Enormously deep and complex economic relationships. But of course, China continues to get big. But what I think is so interesting is that East Asian states, despite China's skyrocketing influence in terms of its economy, and here's the size of its economy from 1975 to 2000, right, is that these countries are not actually stepping away in terms of fear and balancing against China. And the best indicator of that is how much they spend on their defense as a percentage of their gross domestic product, as their economy. You can always find some guy in Japan who's going to say, oh, I hate China, or let's balance, someone in Vietnam to claim blah, 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 blah. But the best way is what they actually do, not what they say. And here, Southeast Asian countries, Indonesia, Malaysia, Philippines, Thailand, Singapore, and Vietnam, during the height of the Cold War, 75 to, say, 1989 or so, they spent an average of around 4% of their economies on defense. When real threats to their existence dropped, so did their defense spending. So now they spend an average of about 2%. And you will literally, I mean, this is the main empirical argument that I made. I'm going to show you one other way, which is this is just 3-year average from 88 to 90 at the height of the Cold War, and then the last 3 years that were available. So South Korea was spending 4%, now 2%. You know, 2%, 1.9. Every single country of note in East Asia, the defense spending has declined significantly. Vietnam's perhaps the most interesting. For some reason, I have no idea why this data is not available. I checked Cypri, I checked a bunch of places, right? But we know that in the 70s and 80s, Vietnam was spending 5, 10, 15% of their economy on defense. They were worried about a number of external threats. Since then, the numbers have dropped down to roughly 2%. So why do I use these numbers like this? Because if they could spend 4% of their economy on defense, and now they're spending less than half that. Here's Indonesia, 2% in 1988, less than 1% now. Right? If they could spend double what they're spending now, I don't care what you tell me about how worried you are about China. When they feared for their survival, these countries spent a lot on defense. They're spending less now. Until these numbers go back up to Cold War levels, I'm not backing down on the argument that they're not balancing China, no matter what they say. No matter what we hope they say. And that's really interesting, because you will hear an increasing sort of roar from America about how everyone's worried about China's growth. But this is Indonesia's president. I didn't put the quotes on there, right? But both Indonesia's president and prime minister, after the U.S. said we're going to put troops in Darwin in Australia, they were like, well, I don't know. Let's not be too hasty. Fairly worried about, and the actual quotes, I should have put down the quote from the president, was, the region is very dynamic. I'm not sure it's really suitable anymore to have just one power be the dominant power, blah, 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 blah. Right? So why is this interesting? It's interesting for a number of reasons. Number one, our theory of balancing says precisely the opposite. The bigger that China gets, the more scared should countries like Korea and Vietnam be. Precisely because China doesn't even need a navy to get there. Right? We're the ones who actually shouldn't have to worry. Right? We've got a whole ocean between us and China. Right? But we don't see the same kind of fear or behavior that we would predict our standard IR theories would predict. So that's what I find very interesting. Now, What happens a lot of times when I do this talk, I was just over at another university and a very prominent Japan specialist said to me, yes, they are balancing. It's like, no, they're not. Yes, they are. Aside from the name calling, right? That's why I think these indicators are very important, right? The question becomes both, how do you explain this away and then why? Well, there's a billion realist defenses, and here's where Peter Katzenstein has been pushing me for the last 10 years to stop dealing with the balancing hypothesis, because it so obviously isn't wrong. So I'm going to go on to the why. And the main argument, actually, for why not, is that many of these countries have not sorted out their relationship with China. That's very clear. I'm going to talk about some of the things they haven't sorted out. But very few countries fear a Chinese military invasion. They don't fear for their survival from China. And I don't think any responsible analyst, even in the United States, thinks that China poses any military threat to Vietnam's survival or Korea's survival. Much less, obviously, getting on boats and rowing over to Japan or something like that. So they don't spend more. I mean, it's a pretty straightforward argument. When they were worried about surviving, they were worried, and they've armed themselves. Now they're not. And very few of us can envision that kind of a scenario. US and China might have to work something out. Even there, it's hard for us to envision a war other than, say, over Taiwan. Who fears for their survival in East Asia? Now only two countries, Taiwan and North Korea. The smallest countries, not the biggest ones. So what is the barrier then? Why, if they're not necessarily worried about invasion, aren't things, you know, why isn't everything like Europe or America, right? And I thought I'd give you the best view I can in a talk is to talk about Chinese nationalism. Because I think it's a great window on the kind of points that I'm making, which is, does China have values that others respect? We could talk all day simply about Chinese nationalism, how Chinese culture is changing. Alan's done a great job on this. But I just have a couple points. One is, essentially, we have a view of China, which is, you know, here they are fighting Georgetown, you may remember last year. Tibet and China are one, a sort of hysterical overreaction to other people saying Tibet should be free. Here's Chinese, good Chinese nationalists waving the Chinese flag. Now, there's a couple things about Chinese nationalism I think is very interesting. Number one, and I'm happy to talk about this more. Number one, we have no problem at all saying Chinese nationalism is essentially a century of shame and bitterness at the West and the United States. The historical link is obvious. So history really, really affects how Chinese view the world. That's basically, I would call it the conventional wisdom, and Alan can correct me if I'm wrong, but sort of, you know, I'm not saying it's right, but that's sort of conventional wisdom about Chinese nationalism, right? Bitterness at Japan for imperialism, bitterness at the unequal treaties, et cetera, et cetera. And it's very clear today that that's an element of it, a sort of either defensive or aggressive nationalism, you know, how dare you criticize us, et cetera. But whatever else, it's very interesting that that's what people, when they look at China, motivates them, right? It's not necessarily how big China is. A different nationalism, they might be very different. Now, what I find more interesting than that, because that's the caricature, that's the cartoon you're going to see, is that there is a debate going on in China today and around the world about what China should value, what it does value, and what it might value. And we tend to poo-poo these things. But I think there's more to it than that. Right? There is a whole other discussion in China about, is there maybe an alternative story we can tell about ourselves? We've been telling ourselves one story. Oh, how evil the Western powers were. Now, we all laugh when they try and set up Confucius Institutes or talk about Zheng He's peaceful trading ships and blah, blah, blah. My point is not whether or not it's going to be successful. My point is, in China today, there's a big debate going on about how do we view ourselves? Can we look back on 5,000 years of being a civilizational center of the world with pride and self-confidence? Of having amazing technological advancements and in some ways perhaps not doing what the European powers did? How does this fit with that view of we're really angry at everyone? And there's an active discussion about whether China can have soft power, hard talk on this. I don't know, I just got this off the web, right? And this is an unnamed university, right? But what I find interesting about this is that it is a discussion going on in China about what they stand for. Who are we, right? I mean, my short, and this is totally unfair, but my short discussion of Chinese domestic identity is whatever was traditional got wiped out during communism because nobody wanted to be known as being a capitalist rotor or whatever else. So we burn all the books and everything. Cultural Revolution, Great Leap Forward. But whatever communist values were there were also then totally destroyed with the reform era. Like, forget that communism stuff. And so now it's basically people are trying to figure out, what do we have? What do we stand for? We certainly don't stand for communism and world solidarity anymore. Do we really want to go back to feudal, blah, 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 right? But it's a conversation that's going on in China, and it hasn't been sorted out yet. And how it gets sorted out, along with how Japan, Korea, Vietnam, and else sort out their discussions about who they are and what they care about, is going to be much more important for whether these countries get along or not than probably whether China is 50 or 51 times larger than Vietnam. Now, the other thing to point out is that it's not unique to China. The thing I always point out, Japan has territorial disputes with every single country that it could have territorial disputes with. There's nobody else, right? This is Russia, the northern territories. They still have not sorted that out. This is Dokdo Takeshima, which we'll talk about in a minute. And obviously down here, it's the sort of China, Taiwan, et cetera, islands, right? Japanese haven't quite sorted out where they really think they fit in East Asia, or are they really something different or not? And I had to show this, I couldn't resist. Right? Yasukuni Shrine, it's, how many people have been? One, two. You should go, it's fascinating. A lot of things I could say about that compared to, say, for example, the Vietnam War Memorial or the Korea War Memorial, right? But they haven't necessarily sorted out this is during cherry blossom, right? And interesting, of course, Korea, deterring a rising power, is going to build a naval base near a disputed island. Oh, but look, they're going to spend $300 million to deter Japan from taking over these disputed islands. And does anybody know Dokdo Takeshima? Nobody lives there. They're literally like barely sticking out of the water. But Korea's going to spend $300 million on a naval base here. So either we take this seriously that Korea, of course, they don't necessarily love China. I'm not naive. I'm not stupid. Right? I'm not saying everybody loves China. But the point is their concerns are different. China's one of them. It's not the only one. It's probably not the primary concern. They have a lot of other things they're trying to figure out. And the thing I always tell Koreans about their national identity is, why are you so insecure compared to Japan? Who cares what Japanese think? It doesn't get me a lot of friends in Korea. Because they really care. And I'm like, why do you care? Right? But the point is that when I think about how China fits into the region, it's really a regional view. Let me blank this for a minute. Right? It's really a regional view. China's part of the region. They have centuries of relations with each other. Some have worked out, some haven't. But what I think is fascinating is that China's rise has not yet gone the way that Aaron Friedberg and John Mearsheimer desperately hope that it goes, frankly, right? Which is all the East Asian countries fearing China's rise, bandwagoning over the US or clinging to the United States. So explaining why that's the case is very interesting. At the same time, to say that does not mean, on the other extreme, that everybody loves China, and that the region's already stable. It is far more stable than it was 50 years ago. But, for example, and let me just try and emphasize this, right? To say that it's not as dangerous as many people in the United States expect or think does not mean that it's the other extreme, that everybody loves China. It's a pretty simple argument, right? It's sort of somewhere in the middle. But as somebody told me once, right? The only place you get run over is right if you're in the middle of the road. Right? But it's not that complex. So what about the future then, right? What What do I think is going to happen? Let me make sure I have my notes here. Right. In part, this comes back to some very interesting theoretical things for you grad students out there or whatever, right? In part, this comes down to, are we identical? And can our simple spare models that assume power and certain kinds of interests, can they explain the entire world? Or are we similar, but with some important differences? And how do you take that seriously and make sense out of it? How do you take seriously history and culture that are affecting the way these countries view themselves and each other? It's far easier to say, two countries, two issues, what are they bargaining about? Here's my preference orderings. I come down on this side. These things are important. How they view themselves, how they develop their own cultures and identities and things like that, right? So my conclusion about East Asia today is more stable than it's been at any time since the arrival, of the English at the Opium Wars in 1840. That started a massive change, chaos change. Everything has changed. By the mid-70s, many states were organizing, new states, old states, reorganizing themselves. The region, by any measure, wars, deaths, fear, is far more stable now than it's been at any time since, say, 1839. That doesn't mean it's like Europe. It probably never will be. I think that's the wrong comparison. But interestingly enough, and where I think it really gets interesting is this, which is, and I did remember, good for me. Do we have any students from mainland China here?
Wow.
Do you have a passport? I know the answer to that, but how many of you have a passport? You wouldn't be here if you didn't, right? How many of you have ever questioned the fact that you have a piece of paper that somehow says who you are and where you fit? Said, why do we have these things anyway? Right? Why is this thing the most important document that I'm going to own probably in my life? Is anybody? Anybody in America ever? I never did until I started doing this research, right? In many ways, the Western ideas, the Western-derived ideas of nation-states, a passport that determines nation-state citizenship, they're normative around the world, and not even China has any alternative to it. That's my point. The return to, there may be a Confucian identity and a history in China, and a return to some types of those values, but the international system is different. The international system has changed. We all live in this Westphalian world now, and nobody really questions it. We're beginning to, at the margins, question nation states and nationalism. But certainly in East Asia, they're quite solidly in sort of like the 20th century in terms of nations and nationalism. I'll give you an example of a country that is sort of questioning that. I do a video course with a Mexican university on East Asian security, and one of them was telling me the other day, there was a poll done in Mexico last year where they said, would you be willing to merge with the United States if your quality of life would go up? 52% of people were like, yeah, who cares, right? Which is unthinkable in East Asia, right? Say to Koreans and Japanese, would you be willing to merge if your quality of life would go up? 0%, right? I'd probably get punched simply for asking the question, right? Get out, right? But nobody questions nation state. This is a recent conception in East Asia, and that is coexisting or melding with a bunch of other historical ideas. Oops. Right? So here's King Kojong, the last Korean king. He ruled until the Japanese came in and colonized Korea. Here he is in the traditional pajamas. Traditional Korean garb, right? Here he is, the same guy dressed like Bismarck. Right? This is, you can do this for every country in Asia, right? He's got the beard, the handlebar mustache, the medals, the sword, the gloves, right? Why? This is how we used to do East Asia. There was a set of rules, and I'm happy to talk about it, a set of rules and ideas for governing relations between unequal countries, right? All of a sudden, it was like, no. If we want to be a country and survive, we got to act like the Western countries, and they really learned their lesson. So what is interesting about today? China is no longer the center of civilization that it was. One of the things is that if you talk to a Korean without saying, what do you think of China? And you just say, you're just talking about like learning Chinese characters. And everyone will say, man, I wish I knew them better because so many of our words come from China, right? Japan, Tale of Genji was written based on a Chinese a novel, so to speak, at the time. Vietnam, Chinese characters. An examination system based on Confucian classics. China was the source of civilization in East Asia, of ideas and learning. Countries looked to it. Talk about a hegemon or a leader. Historically, Koreans weren't coerced into learning Chinese characters. They wanted to get over to China so they could see what the latest scholars did. Japan the same way. Japanese emperors were buried with what they call Chinese prestige artifacts, like a jade comb or something from China, porcelain bowls, for centuries. Right? China was a source of civilization and learning and appeal. Today, China's no longer the center of civilization. There's few countries that look to China as a model. There's grudging respect, right? Nobody's looking to Greece today. Greece was the source of Western civilization, and nobody's looking to Greece for leadership today, particularly on economic issues. I know, that's gallows humor, that's not funny, right? Right? But it was. But today, Greece is it's had a huge impact, but no longer is Greece a leader. There's respect for China's economic accomplishments. But China is not a leader today. And the question is, can these countries find a way that they're going to interact with each other so that they can actually move beyond sort of respect and sort of arm's length and truly have some type of deep understanding of what each other wants and where each other deserves to be? So they haven't sorted it out yet. Will they be able to? I have no idea. The thing I always conclude, and people always think this is too much of like a graduation speech, but it's true, right? The future is being written today, right? I have no idea what's going to happen. The decisions most of you make is going to have an effect on what happens in the future, right? So that's why it sounds too much of a graduation. But it's true, right? The decisions we make today are going to have an effect on that in China, in Korea, in Japan, in the United States. But I will conclude one more time by saying it's not going to be balance of power or economic interdependence. It's this stuff which is far more important. So I will stop there, and I'm happy to talk about whatever you would like to talk about. Thank you. Go ahead, you can do it, sure. You know better, so why don't you lead and I'll just not all at once.
By asking you to expand on your vision, of course, you don't know what the future is gonna hold, and you don't think anyone does, and you're right. But it seems to me you were describing a possibility of order and stability in East Asia that isn't provided by people's sense of how horrible war is, because that's universal, and it's not provided by economic interdependence, also universal. There's something, a distinctive possibility in East Asia of an order that isn't based on commerce or fear of killing. Could you describe a version of that order? Because you said it's not going to be the tribute system anymore. It's not going to be we all look to a Confucian ethic that comes from China. It's going to be something else. What's an example of something else?
Started with the easy one, huh? Oh, that's yours. Okay.
Oh,
I think it fell.
Oh, okay.
It's like, what did I do?
That was very impressive. It's like, that on purpose sometimes.
What did I do? Okay. So you can still hear me?
Yeah, I mean,
you know, if okay. Obviously, we all know the pessimistic path, right? And I would be better off served by saying, I don't know. The situation doesn't look very good. There's a lot of problems in East Asia. I've been on panels where people have sat and gone through every possible problem, from environmental decay to drug running and blah, 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 you know, and then sat back. And I said, you're absolutely right. There are a huge number of problems if you want to think about East Asia and the kinds of problems there. Turn this one off. There. Can you hear better now?
Yes.
Okay. Should I start over? I can't remember what I was saying. Lots of problems, that's right, right? So you can never go wrong. I don't know. Can you put that on video? I don't know. Really worried, right? Because there are huge problems, right? Environmental decay, there could be an economic implosion in China, rural urban unrest, maritime territorial disputes, historical disputes, which I'd love to talk about, right? Lots of disputes that exist. So the bad side is pretty easy to do. The sort of more hopeful side, or the optimistic side, would say there's a couple things that could stitch these countries together, right? Certainly there's a shared among, and I'm talking now about, say, East Asia in particular. If we talk about the main states, Japan, Korea, China, Vietnam. Southeast Asia is different. Then there's South Asia, there's West Asia, et cetera. But let's just take those four, which when we tend to talk about China and blah, 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 we tend to talk about those four. Will it upset the balance of power? Who's balancing, right? So what is it? Certainly, number one, there is a shared cultural history. The amazing thing, if you get my business card, you'll see I have Chinese characters on it, right? Not only because as a Korean, I have a Korean name, which is done in Chinese characters, but I make sure that it's on there because anywhere I go from Japan through Vietnam, I can give the card and everyone can read it. Vietnam, not so much anymore. Korea, not so much anymore. They're starting to relearn them, right? There is a shared cultural background, history, right? There's a shared set of intriguing ideas and things to build on that in many ways, like for example, you didn't have as much even in Europe that you do in East Asia of a cultural civilizational background. Certainly there's a tremendous amount of mixing there going around, right? The largest ethnic minorities all over the place are Chinese, blah, 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 right? But beyond that, when we get to the political level, I think it's a couple things, right? One is all countries come into terms with their history, and it's not just China. Think of the problems that Korea and Japan have with their own histories. This is not going to be easy. But Japanese aren't really comfortable with it. South Koreans aren't. I mean, if you start actually peeling back that layer of how South Korea treated its own citizens during the war, North Korea, and then clearly China is going to have a very difficult time dealing with its history. Right? Because as long as, if you can't do anything after 1949, it's going to be a long time before you actually get a Chinese populace that is comfortable talking about history and saying, we made some mistakes, here were some things that happened to us. If everything after 1949 is off limits, we're waiting a long time. But then that depends, right? Does China at some point make some kind of a transition beyond a one-party state? You know, it's much, much looser now than it was. I think in 2012, we are far farther in terms of openness than when I was like in college in the 80s when people thought of China opening up. I don't think anybody thought they'd get to where they are today in terms of openness, right? So it's that type of thing. If a China transitions and transforms a generation from now, Koreans, right? A unified Korea. Again, don't hold your breath, right? But these are the kinds of things that are the barriers, and if those barriers get changed or removed, there is a real possibility for a different Asia, one that isn't totally focused backwards or on unresolved Cold Wars like in North and South Korea or on what the communists did or democracy. I know it's a long-winded answer, but I think it deserves more of an answer because there are alternative pathways out there. I just don't know whether we'll get there, how long it will take, or anything else. How's that?
But wouldn't you say that in defense of realism, perhaps there's a threshold after which balancing by a boost to defense funding isn't really practical anymore, and that the Asian situation could potentially be characterized by that because there's already a huge power gap in terms of size and
influence? Let me ask you a question.
Influence.
How much smaller does North Korea have to get compared to the United States to give up?
point.
I don't see them giving in. Vietnam fought, they call it the first, second, and third wars of independence during the 20th century. First against the French, then against us, and then against China. All three of those. I mean, how much bigger were we? We dropped more bombs on Vietnam than we did during all of World War II, and they didn't give up. What I find astonishing, just to talk about Vietnam, what I find truly astonishing, and I didn't even live through Vietnam. I don't even I wasn't born then, right? But I've read about it. Seems to me, obviously, they were willing to die, you know, in greater numbers than we could kill them. So we finally decided to stop. And what I find astonishing in America today, of the last presidential election, is people starting to say, we could have won. I don't know if you guys heard that or not. I just am flabbergasted that somebody today could be saying, actually, we didn't have enough resolve in Vietnam. But the point is, how much bigger than Vietnam did we have to be for them to actually give up, right? My point being this. These countries, when they're threatened, seem to go down swinging. So if they're not going down swinging now, again, and you're, no, and I'm not picking on you at all, but you are a good realist because you say, well, just a little bit more. How much power is enough? Just a little bit more, right? But frankly, I don't see how much bigger we can get than North Korea for them to give up, or Vietnam, how much bigger we could have been for them to give up. And then all of a sudden, 20 years later, they decide to capitulate. I don't see that. I think the reason they're not arming now is because they're not really there. They don't like what's going on in Spratly's with Vietnam, but that's different than fearing a major invasion. One of the things about water, people don't live there. It's a very different type of dispute if you have boats rocking on the water than if you have to worry about people and movements and everything else. And so the Vietnamese, when China and them hadn't sorted out with Cambodia and all that kind of stuff, they had a bloody war in 1979. And horrifically bloody. So now all of a sudden they've decided, well, now we can't fight. I don't see that. I think if Vietnam was threatened, they would go down swinging.
But. So if you put it, you're envisioning not a Yates the Second Coming, you're envisioning global prosperity.
Not the?
Like Yates the Second Coming, the end is near, is the mainstream political rhetoric. And we are really right now, right? That's
what they're saying. So it's a debate. If you're running for president, that's not the thing to say.
You see an expanding pie where economic policy is going to be the large part of the debate. China right now is kind of taking non-interventionist stances with a lot of countries around the world, and that is still some concern about the European Union and the United States. How do you see their evolving position on these issues affecting not just their significance in their area, but globally?
I think that's a great question. I don't know if you guys heard, but it's like, you know, China's not interfering a lot of times. Now we're annoyed at them because they're not interfering. You know, they're not supporting peacekeeping, et cetera, et cetera. The belief is that way, right? Here's why I often get, my wife tells me, you know, you should start out every talk hammering on how bad China is. Human rights, pollution, blah, 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 right? And then make your argument. Because if you just make the argument, people think you're a panda hugger, right? Because here's the thing. What I find so interesting about that is the way that we, often our fears about China, I think, reflect more of what we're worried about than what's going on with China, right? So I should say, oh, China, horrible, horrific human rights abuser, blah, blah, blah. That being said, so here's how they get hoisted on their own petard or whatever, right? On the one hand, they're not deeply involved in things. So they should be more of a global leader or whatever, get more involved. The minute they do get involved, oh my God, they're trying to usurp us. What the hell are you doing? And you see this in Africa. I get asked about Africa. I get newspaper calls all the time. And I'm not defending anybody's record in Africa because everybody exploits that continent. Right? I'm not saying anybody's doing a good job, but I must have had a dozen reporters call me and say, China's getting a lot of influence in Africa. And I say to them, have you seen the movie Blood Diamond? We've been exploiting Africa for 200 years. We don't care about that continent. Now that China's doing it too, we're all of a sudden worried about what they're doing, right? I'm not saying who's worse, but the point is I think we have a very interesting standard. I'll give you one final one because I think this is very interesting because this is the path, though, that China has to take. This is the path that Japan tried to take 100 years ago when they tried to become a great power. And they sort of got there halfway, but not quite into the club. Right? The path that China has to take is becoming responsible, being involved, being a leader, but not going so far that we, you know, that Americans get worried or something. And in some ways, I'm not actually sure at what point the United States is a moot question. You know, like this is sort of a Chinese kind of thing. And I'll give you an example, a Korean example. On the one hand, everybody, and I guarantee if you Google China-North Korea relations right now, in the last month, there must have been a dozen op-eds. China's the most important partner on North Korea. They've got to do more to pressure North Korea on nuclear weapons. And then I guarantee if you Google China, North Korea, takeover, or province, or whatever else, there's another dozen articles that say, oh my God, they're going to take over North Korea. So again, right, if they involve themselves, we're all worried that they're going to try and take over North Korea. If they don't involve themselves, we criticize them for not involving themselves. What's the answer? I don't know. But I do think it tells us more about us than it does about China. I don't think Korea or Japan is actually different that much with regards. I mean, their histories are different. Oh, sorry. Why would Koreans be less fearful of China than Japan, I think, right? And in some ways, I think I would put it slightly differently, which is that I think the Japanese have always had a relationship with Chinese culture and trade and commerce, right? They borrowed books and blah, blah, blah. But they didn't have really a relationship with China. Whereas Koreans had a relationship with both Chinese culture and Chinese people, right? The Japanese, interestingly enough, we talk about this all the time, right? Are they really Asian? They say we're not quite. We're really more Western, you know. And they're afforded the luxury because they're not quite involved. Although clearly from the outside, they use a lot of Chinese characters. All three writing systems, hiragana, katakana, and obviously kanji, they're all derived from Chinese radicals, you know. So I'm not sure. I mean, today, the present day, when you do talks in Japan, there's no talk in Japan, and I've been all around that country, about the interesting thing about Japan, which I think is so interesting, is I think they're happy to sort of settle into middle power status, right? I don't see any sense of crisis in Japan, although we keep hoping that they'll step up and blah, 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 but the number of students going abroad is lower. I just did this lecture in my undergrad class at USC, and the average TOEFL score, North Korea has a higher average TOEFL score than does Japan. Now, I know that's not fair. There's only two North Koreans, and they're, you know, Kim Jong-nam, right? I don't care. I don't care who it is, right? Japan should be higher. It's the, you know, richest country in the world, right? They're not interested. There's no sense of crisis, and they're sort of fading. How much do external forces, like American military deployments, affect Chinese views of themselves, and might it cause a backlash in some ways, right? I think some, clearly, right? You know, America can certainly do things that are going to make things worse or better with China and the way Chinese people view themselves. My sense, though, is that this is much more domestic set of questions for China and its leaders, you know, people and their leaders. Again, Alan is probably the one who should be talking about this, not me, right? But this is what's so fascinating. So I'm in Shanghai last year, sitting around with a bunch of my Chinese, my friends, right? Some Chinese that I know. We're sitting around some cafe, and everybody's just lambasting on the government, right? It's so corrupt, blah, 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 blah. And so I was like, you know, are you sure it's okay to say that? And they said, yeah, as long as you don't write anything down, you can say whatever you want now, right? Don't put it on the web. And there was a pot of flowers in the middle, and so I was like, just to be, I really like the Communist Party, you know, just in case, right? Dave Kong, right? But, you know, the thing is, it's in many ways, of course, what America does, the Tibet reactions and things like that, they provoke in some ways, I think, a more superficial response, right? But I think the deeper questions that Chinese are dealing with is only partially about their relations with the outside world. I think much more, when I see what they're talking about, it's how their kids are getting educated, you know, where they went to school, pollution, environment, what the government's doing, corruption. And those are a whole bunch of questions about how they should interact with their government, how their government should interact with them, et cetera, et cetera. So I think, yes, obviously America has something to do with it, but I think this is as much a domestic issue as it is anything international. Is this the last one? Okay, so no, that's okay. Just we'll have, how about two? We'll take two. And ask them together, yes. Okay, good. And how about we ask the next one? I'll try and. Well, I can guarantee the near future. No, right? He just got reelected. Ma and Joe just got reelected. So, no, this is a great question. I'm sorry, because one of the things that I said in China Rising, the book that I talked about there, and I'll start with the Taiwan one, is that the question about Taiwan is not a question of economic independence and balance of power, right? The question about Taiwan is it a nation state or is it not? Right? It's a question of what is Taiwan. It's an identity question. It's a values question. Right? That's the issue. And to all of us, superficially, we all know the answer. No, it's not. The U.S. has formally said, no, it's not. It's all part of one China. You just don't fight as you sort out who's the leader of China. We've said that. Every country in the world essentially has said that, other than like 23. But then we've got a set of beliefs that say it's a democracy. It's got its own economy, its own dollars. Of course it's a country, right? And the sort of legal, what we did as a nation state in signing treaties and normalizing diplomatic relations is one thing, and what we sort of think about what Taiwan is a different thing. Culturally, of course, they all speak Chinese. It's amazing, right? I mean, in many ways, Taiwan is more traditional than China because they use traditional characters, you know? They're more conservative, right? So the question really is how that works out, and I could talk, again, for a whole hour about it. But my sense is a lot of people are less worried about Taiwan right now because on a political basis, two things have happened. Number one, the Taiwanese urge to declare formal independence has sort of abated a little bit. They sort of backed away from that. They're happy to be de facto independent because you can go to Taiwan and you can buy a book about Chiang Kai-shek or whatever, right? I mean, you know, you can use traditional characters. But they don't want to, they're just willing to kick the can down the road for a while. China, on the other hand, has, in a way, I think, stepped back from threatening and sending missiles over and scaring the wits out of everybody and decided that they were going to try and use economic interdependence. Well, we'll wait a generation. We'll see what happens once Taiwan, half the population from Taiwan has moved to China and blah, 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 right? They're at 10% or something already, I think. But 1.5 million have moved back. So they're willing, we'll just wait. So I think in the near term, both sides have decided, let's just back off, let's just sort of see what happens, right? You know, the thing about Chinese values that I find interesting, and I am not a China domestic anthropology person, it's just I have some friends there, you know, some of my best friends are Chinese. But the thing is, like, the thing that I think interesting about China is, on the one hand, you have 60 years of communism where they tried to wipe out the traditional ways of doing things. And then you had communism where everyone was wearing a Mao suit and carrying the red book and stuff, right? That didn't last. I mean, that was like a generation maybe. But when I walk around now, there isn't a whole lot of values, right? And I don't mean to insult all of you Chinese, right? But I mean, you know, sort of a clear set of values for what you stand for and what's right and what's wrong, it's not quite there. But there's a lot of roots. I think there's a lot of historical roots about family relations and family obligations and ways in which you expect the government to interact with each other that are sort of latent, that are little sprouts. My sense is China would probably be more like a South Korea than anything else. North Koreans are really angry at South Koreans because South Korea is nothing like the Confucian country that North Korea is. I mean, South Korea is totally modernized now. But there are roots, Confucian or traditional roots, in Korean culture, although it's incredibly westernized. And some horrifying things happen, like boyfriend and girlfriend walk around holding hands in public. Now, I know, you're shocked. No, right? But it's changed. When I first went to Korea in the mid-80s, you didn't see that, right? You just didn't hold hands with your girlfriend. Now you do. No, my point, I don't want to joke about Korea too much, right? Korea, number one. But my sense for China is that there are deep roots that a generation or so did not wipe out. And the question for China is getting back to some of the roots that you should justifiably be proud of and then integrating them to a modern world where clearly things are different, economically, culturally, politically, whatever else, right? And it's a test. Taiwan has done it. Singapore has done it. I mean, you know, China as a country will find its way, I think. That's what I ultimately think, long run, right? So I guess that's about it.
What